Iran speaking of an ongoing process of unfreezing its assets held in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions. At least one settler is killed in a shooting attack, which Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says is a response to Israeli crimes. And in a case that has horrified the U.K., a nurse is sentenced to life in prison for murdering seven babies and trying to kill six others. World News. I'm Hazi Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Iran's assets blocked in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions have been reportedly transferred to Switzerland's central bank for exchange and transfer to Iran. South Korea's official news agency, Yonhap, says the Swiss bank will convert the $6 billion fund into euros in the next few weeks, and the sums will be transferred to Iran. South Korea's finance ministry has refrained from commenting on the issue. Last week, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi also said the released assets will be used to enhance the country's domestic production. Iran says a process is underway for the release of its assets held in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said in his weekly presser that the steps taken by the Iranian government have forced the U.S. to accept and fulfill Tehran's demands. Nasser Kanani said part of Iran's foreign assets in Iraq are also being released. Kanani added that Iran has never backed away from pursuing the rights of the nation and will not do so in the future. Earlier, we were joined by political analyst Tim Anderson. He said South Korea's move to freeze Iran's assets was a step taken under U.S. pressure.
There's a very strange debate going on in the U.S. that suggesting that the Biden administration is somehow giving Iran money that, you know, that it wasn't Iran's to start with. But it, as I understand it, it's Iran's money from sale of oil to Korea. Now, the interesting thing is how Korea's been involved in this. Korea, of course, is a very dependent state, which militarily occupied by the U.S. for more than 70 years. And which pretty much does what it's told. I mean, the Europeans do the same sort of thing, really, too. But Korea's in a difficult situation because it's carried out a transaction. It hasn't paid for the presumably the oil that Iran sent it. And now you have most of the oil exporters in the world under some sort of blockade, economic blockade by the U.S. In other words, there's a generalized situation in the world now where oil importers like South Korea and many other countries, on the one hand, under pressure from the U.S. to do what the U.S. tells them. On the other hand, they're damaging their own credit ratings and their capacity to buy things for their own populations if they refuse to pay for the goods that they're receiving. You know, so this is creating a serious problem because these U.S. so-called sanctions, which are really unilateral coercive measures, are making trade very difficult for everyone, not just the people that they're trying to attack, but also third parties, if you like South Korea.
Well, Tehran has once again vehemently condemned the recent desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark, warning that Muslims will not tolerate such blasphemous acts. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has cautioned about severe growth of extremism, violence, and terrorism in Europe. He made the remarks during a presser with his Malaysian counterpart, Zamri Abdul Qadir, in Tehran. The two top diplomats also agreed to boost bilateral ties across various sectors, including trade and cultural spheres. Developments in Syria, Afghanistan, and Palestine came in the spotlight also. Amir Abdullahian said West Asian nations are now experiencing a new chapter in their relations. Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammed Bakr Qalibaf meets his Algerian counterpart, Ebrahim Boukali, in Tehran. In a press conference after the meeting, Qalibaf said both countries reiterated the need for developing bilateral, regional, and international cooperation. He also said an economic commission between the two nations will be launched soon. The speaker also expressed Tehran's willingness to cooperate with Algiers to counter the repeated desecration of the Holy Quran in Europe Bughali, for his part, said his country looks forward to closer cooperation with Iran. A U.S. helicopter carrier in the Strait of Hormuz region has landed its aircraft after a warning by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. The choppers had violated Iranian territory and flew close to its vessels. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the latest episode in the Persian Gulf region.
Time now for the news review. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it's warned a U.S. helicopter carrier in the Strait of Hormuz after it was caught trying to fly choppers in the area.
U.S. Navy warship, this is Stefan Aviation Station. Your helicopter is in vicinity of my vessels and Hingham oil field also. Sometimes going to Iranian territorial waters, advise you to take them on your boat and do not enter in Iranian territorial waters. If you do not obey my orders, we will open fire on your helicopters. Over.
The commander of the IRGC's Navy, Alireza Tangsiri, says that a U.S. vessel was forced to ground the choppers. He said that this took place in the presence of Iranian naval vessels and their warning. He made a comment in a meeting of top IRGC commanders where footage of the incident was shown. He added that the August 17th incident was the first entry by American forces into the Persian Gulf since November 2021. Tehran has time and again warned away U.S. warships for approaching its waters. Iran says its foreign presence in the Persian Gulf is a security threat that should be stemmed. Now, we're discussing this a bit, so let me invite a couple of guests. Shapir Rizvi is a political commentator in Chicago. Ali Salam is editor-in-chief of Basira Press here in Tehran. Good to have both of you. So, let me begin with Shapir Rizvi. Shapir, first, one basic question. Why should the U.S., warships come all the way from the other side of the planet to this part of the world?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a simplistic question worth asking. The United States always engages in what we call probing missions. You see it right now in the Persian Gulf. You see it in the South China Sea. And even as we speak, at this very moment, it's not using a destroyer ship, but it's actually using Predator drones to actually fly through the Black Sea. And what it tries to do is it tries to see how far it can actually go before it can get a response from whichever state is trying to get a response from. And what it's ultimately trying to do is establish a norm of, hey, we actually are on these waters all the time. Why are you bullying us? But that's actually completely on top of its own head, because these waters clearly belong to whichever state that they're actually probing into. And so what they're just trying to do is just trying to kind of gauge what kind of response that they should expect and try to push that envelope forward and forward each time they do it.
Okay, Ali in Tehran, let me ask you this. I wonder if, which state in this region should be interested in actually soliciting U.S. assistance in any way? Or how would the U.S. military presence help anyone in this part of the world?
The U.S. military presence does not help anybody in this part of the world or in any part of the world. We know full well that the United States is behind the creation of ISIS, the very sadistic terrorist group. Of course, the Israeli Mossad also had a role in the creation of this group in order to weaken the resistance axis, which supports the resistance in Palestine and in Lebanon. As we can see, that their sole interest is in hegemony and domination over the region in order to essentially make the world in their image. So the fact that this is happening under the Biden administration shows that there is a continuity of policy, regardless of who is in office. And to be honest, the presidents of America are just figureheads and puppets. It's the Zionist lobby, it's the major corporations and banks, the big pharmaceutical companies, and many other such interest groups which control and dominate the U.S. presidents. And so it's almost as if it's futile to place any trust or hope in negotiating with the West and with the U.S. in particular, because their politicians don't act in good faith. And the real deciders who control U.S. policy are people who you don't know. They're not elected directly by the people of the United States. So the United States should much rather focus on its own problems, which is its crumbling infrastructure, such as the train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, mm-hmm. or the wildfires in Maui, or the homeless crisis, or many other problems that they have on their own soil, instead of trying to unleash terrorist groups or militarily intimidate nations who just don't want to be dominated and want to rule over their own affairs with full sovereignty.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Shabir Rizvi in Chicago, Ali Salam in Tehran. And with that, we come to the end of this episode of the News Review.
Well, Syria says its air defenses have shot down three explosive-laden drones over villages near Idlib and Hama. The defense ministry says the drones belong to terrorist organizations that repeatedly attempt to attack civilians in small towns. Earlier this month, the Syrian army shot down another five drones in the suburbs of Aleppo. The region was once controlled by Daesh terrorists. Now, the group's sleeper cells have carried out similar attacks over the past months, leaving dozens of people dead or wounded. An Israeli settler has been killed and one critically injured in a shooting near the city of Hebron or Al-Khalil, south of the occupied West Bank. Israeli media say Palestinians in a passing vehicle carried out the shooting. Regime forces have cordoned off the area and launched a manhunt for the perpetrators. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed the shooting as a response to Israel's ongoing assaults on Palestinians. The movement says the shooting also marks the 54th anniversary of the arson attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque, which Palestinians blame on Israel. The Israeli military has demolished four Palestinian homes in a village in the eastern occupied West Bank. Regime forces broke into the village near the city of Jericho, also known as Ariha, this morning. They sealed off the area before proceeding with the demolitions. The regime's military has also notified five other homeowners that their homes will be destroyed. Israel regularly razes Palestinian structures under the pretext of lacking construction permits. The United Nations says the regime demolished 54 Palestinian structures across the West Bank only in the month of July. And now to the UK, where a British nurse has been sentenced to life in prison for murdering seven newborn babies and trying to kill another six.
This was a cruel, calculated, and cynical campaign of child murder involving the smallest and most vulnerable of children, knowing that your actions were causing significant physical suffering and would cause untold mental suffering.
Lucy Lethby, 33, was handed a whole life order, meaning she will never be released. She was arrested following a string of baby deaths at the neonatal unit of a hospital in northwest England between June 2015 and June 2016. The prosecution said Lethby killed the infants by injecting them with air, overfeeding them with milk, or poisoning them with insulin. She was absent from court for the final verdicts. The hospital's executives have come under fire for failing to act sooner, are concerned about Lethby, which were reportedly raised by senior doctors as early as 2015. Lethby's motives remain unclear. Well, German police say they have arrested two U.S. soldiers over the death of a young local in the western town of Wittlich. Police say the victim was a 28-year-old man who was stabbed just outside of his home after a fight. According to police, the case against the suspects has been established. Police also said that the case and the detainees have been handed over to American authorities, according to NATO's statute. Some 35,000 U.S. troops are stationed in Germany as part of security agreements that go back to the World War II occupation of the country by Allied forces. And now to Italy, where people are grappling with record-high fuel prices. This month alone, the cost of petrol reached a new record high for the 17th straight day. Max Civilli brings us more from Rome, where he talks about how the prices are affecting Italians' living condition.
In Italy, August is the time when millions of people take their annual holidays. The large majority of the Italians travel to their favorite destinations with their cars. But this summer, Italians are grappling with record high fuel prices that may affect their programs, with the cost of petrol reaching a new record high for the 17th consecutive day this month.
Our lawmakers in that building over there, they are fine in their government cars paid by us citizens. Fuel costs more than 2 euros per liter today. This is pure madness. There is no reason for these hikes. It's just speculation.
According to official data, the price of fuel with standard quality reached 2.019 euros per liter on the highways earlier this week. Petrol price at some service stations has even reached 2.7 euros per litre. The last time when prices were so high was in July 2022, following the start of the war in Ukraine. The country's industry minister, Adolfo Urso, has blamed the rise in the prices of petrol and diesel to policies adopted by the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, also known as OPEC.
Nobody here is saying that the government's version is blatantly false. OPEC doesn't have anything to do with the spike in fuel prices seen in Italy. The truth is that huge amounts of crude oil are available these days, but our country simply doesn't have the refineries to process it. Each and every proposal to invest in new refineries is thwarted by the government's adoption of green energy policies.
The EU has imposed massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia, as well as a ban on Russian oil imports over the war in Ukraine. This measure has severely affected the few refineries located in Italy. Fuel prices affect levels of consumer confidence. According to Italy's Bureau of Statistics, Istat, the country's economic morale plunged sharply in July.
This thing is slipping out of our government's control. Everything costs 30 to 40% more. At this pace, we won't be able to go anywhere in summertime.
Italy's main farmers association, Coldiretti, has warned that in a country like Italy, where almost 90% of the goods travel by road to reach the shelves, the increase in fuel prices will result in sharp spikes, over 30%, in the cost of fruit and vegetables. Max Civilli, Rome.
And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldless edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Double standard tarnishes the reputations of the international institutions that supposedly uphold international law. By treating the ICC as a tool to achieve its own ends, the U.S. regime is undermining the credibility and independence of the court. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, anyone supposing that the newfound enthusiasm in Washington for the International Criminal Court, ICC, would open the door for justice for Palestinians, ought not to hold their breath. A closer look at U.S. policy shows that the imperialist power only supports justice for victims depending on the identity of the perpetrators of the alleged international crimes, and whether doing so would align with Washington's interest. With Biden effectively recognizing the ICC's territorial jurisdiction in Ukraine, the U.S. regime is removing its stated principal objection to the court investigating war crimes by the Zionist regime in Palestine. But this does not mean that the U.S. regime will change its tune and support efforts to hold the fabricated regime of Israel accountable for war crimes. 1 year earlier, the court launched an investigation into international crimes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Palestine is a state party to the court, but the Zionist regime is not. The court's jurisdiction extends to nationals of countries which have not joined the Rome Statute, its founding treaty, when a citizen of a non-member country commits international crime in the territory of a member state. Successive administrations in Washington have rejected this principle, as it would leave U.S. personnel liable to prosecution by the court for crimes that took place in the territory of ICC member states, such as Afghanistan, where the court has an open investigation. The U.S. regime has had a rocky relationship with the ICC, which was established in 2002. Washington treated the court as a threat during the Bush administration, which pressured governments around the world to enter into bilateral agreements requiring them not to surrender U.S. nationals to the ICC, as Human Rights Watch recounts. In 2002, the U.S. regime enacted legislation informally known as the Hague Invasion Act that permits the use of military force to free its citizens or citizens of a U.S. allied country held by or on behalf of the court. The Obama administration took a more circumspect stance towards the court, adopting a policy of case-by-case support for ICC investigations and prosecutors, according to Todd Buchwald, a lawyer who has served in various U.S. government positions. Donald Trump resumed the hostile posture of Bush years, with his national security advisor John Bolton effectively declaring war on the ICC during a 2018 speech at the Federalist Society in Washington. In 2019, the Trump administration banned ICC personnel involved in the court's years-long preliminary examination of the situation in Afghanistan, the first time the court probed crimes committed by U.S. forces from traveling to the U.S. In March 2020, an ICC appeals chamber authorized Fatou Bensouda, then chief prosecutor, to open an investigation in Afghanistan, which could include crimes committed by U.S. military and intelligence personnel, as well as other security forces. Month later, the U.S. regime issued an executive order imposing economic sanctions on the court's chief prosecutor and another court official. The Trump administration's punitive measures were also aimed at undermining the ICC's Palestine investigation. And now the administration in Washington has said that it opposes an ICC probe into the killing of Shirin Abu Aqile, a U.S. citizen and Al Jazeera correspondent who was killed by Israeli regime army sniper while covering a raid in the occupied West Bank. Karim Khan, a U.K. national whose term as ICC chief prosecutor began in June 2021, announced later that year that he decided to deprioritize the investigation into American forces and focus instead on Afghanistan's new rulers. Whether the decision was political or pragmatic, or a mix of both, it left the world's sole superpower off of the hook. Shahrzad Akbar, the former chair of Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, told The Intercept that Khan's decision reinforces the perception that these institutions set up in the West and by the West are just instruments for the West's political agenda. Khan's apparent sidelining of the Palestine investigation and Western powers' sudden enthusiasm for the court only galvanized that long-held perception. The U.S. regime championing international justice for people in Ukraine, on the one hand, while pressuring the Palestinian Authority to stop pursuing war crimes trials at the ICC, on the other, puts the double standards into sharp contrast. Since 2015, the U.S. regime has conditioned aid to the Palestinian Authority on the latter not initiating or actively supporting ICC activity that subjects Israeli nationals to an investigation for crimes against Palestinians. The statutory limitation is both heavy-handed and seemingly in contradiction to the interest of the U.S., which is very happy for the Palestinian Authority to serve as a policing arm of the Zionist regime occupation. A government funding bill approved by a Senate committee in July includes a provision that the U.S. regime president shall provide information to the ICC's Ukraine investigation. Whereas U.S. law previously blocked federal appropriations for the ICC, the bill authorizes $6 million to support the court and $5 million for the Trust Fund for Victims of International Crimes. The proposed legislation also prohibits that funding from going to the PA if the Palestinians obtain the same standing as member states or full membership as a state in the United Nations or any specialized agency thereof, independent of a bilateral agreement with the Zionist regime. These glaring double standards make it clear that U.S. intentions regarding the ICC are more political than principled. Ahmad Abulfol, an international lawyer working with Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group engaged with the ICC's investigation in Palestine, told the Electronic Intifada that the U.S. cannot expect to be taken seriously when its support to international justice and the ICC is evidently selective and motivated by its political agenda. He added, if the U.S. is genuine about international justice and its support of the ICC, it should support it regardless of the nationality of the perpetrator. The U.S. must understand that the ICC is not a tool. The court represents humanity's collective conscience, saying never again to atrocity crimes regardless of the perpetrators and promising justice without fear or favor for all victims of such crimes. The unequal upholding of the international law was recently condemned by several independent UN human rights experts.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Brothers and sisters, the topic that we have been focusing on has been the enlightened journey of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We want to today look at another figure named Talha ibn Ubaidillah. Talha is a famous figure in history. He was somebody who was one of the renowned companions of our Prophet. And his story is really one that gets us to think, how can somebody change so much? They say that Talha was the eighth person to convert, to accept Islam. So Talha, he takes a path where eventually we see that he is the commander of the army that is opposing the Imam of the time in Battle of Jamal. So the question is, what was the downfall of Talha? And we see that one of the outstanding things that happened in his life, and when the shift started to occur, it goes back to a misguided approach towards justice. Okay, and I'm setting the grounds for talking about family because I want to talk about family from the framework of justice and rights and responsibilities. So what was going on? We see that during the time of our Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, he talks about justice and he is a man of justice and he shows people what justice is all about. Everyone is like the comb, the teeth of a comb. They're all equal. This is the type of teachings that the Prophet taught. Don't look at the outer of a person, their skin color or the clothes that they wear. Everyone is a child of Adam and they're to be treated equally. And that's why we see in the seerah and the life history of the Prophet that he constantly emphasized justice, justice, justice. And this continued until the time of the second Khalifa in particular, where he has another idea of justice and he's influenced by the way that things are being done in other lands and other empires, the Romans and the Persians. So what does he say? He says that we have all this money coming into the public treasury. Until now, we divided it equally, but now we're going to change things up. No longer is it the case that everyone is equal. We're going to change what it means to distribute things according to justice. And so what he does is he says that if you are somebody who, for example, you're a muhajir, then you get more than the Ansar. If you migrated, then you get more than the Ansar who are the helpers in Medina. If you are a muhajir and you're from the Quraysh, then you get more than those who were non-Quraysh. Okay, now he starts going further. If you are an Arab, then you get more from the public treasury than if you are a non-Arab. And it continues. If you are a veteran of the Battle of Uhud and Badr, then you get more than if you weren't veterans of these battles. If you converted to Islam and you reverted to Islam before the Fath, before the conquest of Makkah, then you get more than those who reverted to Islam after the conquest of Makkah. If you come from a noble family, then you get more than the families which are really not known. And even though when we think about things now, we say that that's hideous, right? What kind of Islam is that? Right? That was actually what took place in history. And now we see that those companions who previously had sacrificed so much, giving up even his finger, risking his life, when he's tested at this time, we see that he fails the test. And he becomes one of those who gets indulged in the life of this world. Yesterday, I gave you the example of Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas and how he had his own palace, remember? That was given a special name, Qasr Sa'd. Here we see that Talha also has his own palace, which is known as Talhiyin. And people would say that you know, his palace is better than the palace of the Caesars and the Pharaohs and the caliphs. They said that if we had the type of wealth that he would have, then we'd be able to take care of a lot of the poverty that exists in the Muslim world right now. That's how much wealth that he had amassed. Now, what is the sickness that has developed here? What do we see the re-emergence of in the society? It is a pre-Islamic aspect which is now coming back again, which is the notion that justice is not something which is an absolute standard. Rights do not come from anywhere which is absolute. We get to make the rules about how we want to be just. We're the ones who say what's right and what's wrong. Now, this is very important because now let's go to the modern world. We're going to talk about what's happening right now. I'm going to talk about an example, you know, kind of at the global level, and then we're going to bring it back to the family. So, in recent history, and we have to know our history, we know that the world wars have led to the deaths of millions of people. 90 million, 100 million people were killed through wars that were fought for reasons which sometimes you got to wonder exactly what was going on. After World War II, there was a lot of concern about all the blood that was shed. And the United Nations came together and they said that we need to do something about this. So what do? They say that we're going to draft a document which is going to be our standard for justice. And this document is a famous document. It becomes known as the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. It's very interesting. You go study it, you see that it talks about a lot of great things. You know, safety, liberty, freedom, rights. What is the basis of this document? If you go and study it, you see that everything is pivoted around the concept of justice. One of our respected greatest scholars of our current time, by the name of Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, Hafidhahullah, he, in one of his commentaries, he says that this document, from a terminology perspective, it's great. It talks about a lot of good things. But he says that there's a fundamental problem in this document. What is the problem? He says that all those things that they're talking about, there is no basis from which they come. They're just things that the delegates had agreed upon. They said that we're going to respect the life and liberty and property of every human being. Everyone has the right to live like this. Everyone has the right to live in peace. But there is no source that they're going back to, which is informing them that this is not only justice, but this is how you implement justice. And that's the fundamental flaw. When it comes from yourself, the problem is that the standards become shaky. You have nothing that you're committing to. And we see what that leads to in the modern era. You must be aware of the type of injustice that takes place at the hands of those who claim that they are supporters of human rights. You see, for example, the United Nations Secretary General just recently, what does he say? He says that Israel should be added to a United Nations blacklist. Why? He says that it should be added to a United Nations blacklist because of its violence, if its violence against Palestinian children is repeated this year. Okay, great. So he's talking about, you know, the defense of life and liberty, right? But why are you saying that if it repeats this year, then you need to be added to the blacklist? Does that mean that it was okay if it happened last year and the year before and the year before and the year before that as well too? You see that the people now who are tasked with enforcing justice, it becomes something which is very subjective. When they want to weigh in, to what extent they want to weigh in, how they're going to enforce those principles of justice. This is what happens when your system of rights becomes something which depends on yourselves. You see that some of the world leaders, one of the world leaders who came into power saying that Saudi Arabia is a pariah state. This is what he said when he came into power. This is how he was elected. Just recently, you see him fist bumping with Muhammad ibn Salman. Right? This guy has blood on his hands, like, you know, what he does, and here he's fist bumping with him. Right? What does he show you? It means that this notion of justice becomes very shaky.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
ما رو هدایت میکنه.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت، باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و آنگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the FBI has joined an investigation into a barrage of threats against Fulton County, Georgia officials in recent days, including members of the grand jury who voted on Donald Trump's indictment. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Law enforcement in Fulton County, Georgia, are investigating threats to members of the grand jury that returned the indictment against former President Donald Trump and 18 other associates after the grand juror's personal information was shared online. The sheriff's office confirmed on Thursday, 17th of August. The Fulton County Sheriff's Office is leading the effort to track down the origins of the threats and working with local, state, and federal law enforcement, the agency said in a statement. We take this matter very seriously and are coordinating with our law enforcement partners to respond quickly to any credible threat and to ensure the safety of those individuals who carried out their civic duty, the office of Sheriff Pat Labatt confirmed. The sweeping indictment handed up by the grand jury on Monday charges former President Donald Trump and 18 others over their alleged roles in a scheme to reverse the former president's loss in Georgia's 2020 presidential election. The charging document lists 41 counts in all, of which Donald Trump faces 13 counts. The former president has denied wrongdoing and accused Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis, who is leading the investigation, of pursuing politically charged witch hunt. While grand jury proceedings are held behind closed doors, the indictment listed the names of 26 people who made up the panel, although three of the names are crossed out. Legal experts have told the Associated Press that it's standard practice for indictments in Georgia to list the names of the grand jurors without redactions because it gives the defense the opportunity to examine the panel's makeup. The names of grand jurors on the federal level and in most other states typically remain secret, making Georgia an outlier. After the indictment was unsealed, users on social media, including far-right platforms like 4chan, began to call for violence against the grand jurors and against Fannie Willis, the group Advanced Democracy Inc. found. The organization, which monitored the response to Donald Trump's indictment in Georgia, identified one post on the platform X, formerly known as Twitter, that included photographs of some of the grand jury members. The indictment against Donald Trump in Fulton County, Georgia, is the fourth returned by grand juries this year. In addition to the criminal charges in Georgia, the former president is also facing federal charges in southern Florida and in Washington, D.C., the latter of which stem from alleged attempts to stop the transfer of presidential power after the 2020 election. Donald Trump has also been indicted by a district attorney in Manhattan on 34 state felony counts of falsifying business records. The former president has pleaded not guilty in the three cases, and he has yet to be arraigned in Fulton County, Georgia. Donald Trump and the 18 other defendants have until 25th of August to surrender to authorities and are expected to be processed at the Fulton County Jail. His prosecution in Washington has led to threats against the judge presiding over the case, U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan. A Texas woman was arrested last week after she allegedly sent a threatening and racist voicemail to Judge Chutkan. The woman, Abigail Jo Schrey, told Judge Chutkan in part, "You are in our sights and we want to kill you," according to the criminal complaint filed last week. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered this story and tells us more. Members of the Fulton County grand jury that voted to indict former President Donald Trump on Monday are facing threats after their personal information began circulating online according to authorities on Thursday, 17th of August. The Fulton County Sheriff's Office is aware that personal information of members of the Fulton County Grand Jury is being shared on various platforms, the Sheriff's Office said in a statement on Thursday, 17th of August. As the lead agency, our investigators are working closely with local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies to track down the origin of the threats in Fulton County, Georgia, and other jurisdictions, the statement said. We take this matter very seriously and are coordinating with our law enforcement partners to respond quickly to any credible threat and to ensure that the safety of those individuals who carried out their civic duty is ensured. As required by Georgia law, the grand jurors' names were made public by the district attorney's office as part of the grand jury process. In recent days, the information has been circulating online. The FBI is also investigating threats against Fulton County officials, an FBI spokesperson confirmed on Thursday, 17th of August. FBI Atlanta is aware of threats of violence against Fulton County officials and is working with the Fulton County Sheriff's Office, FBI Atlanta spokesperson Tony Thomas said in a statement. Individuals found responsible for making threats in violation of state and or federal laws will be prosecuted, the statement by the FBI confirmed. Former U.S. President Donald Trump and 18 others were charged on Monday in a sweeping racketeering indictment for alleged efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in the state of Georgia. The former president says his actions were not illegal and that the investigation is politically motivated.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. Sometimes false claims and coercive demands are made. Do not accept these. The organization must not give in to coercive demands. Stand by your own positions. Do what you need to do, but do not give it to what they ask you to do with coercion, and do not accept it. Sometimes they make claims that are untrue. Do not accept these claims. They say, you did such and such thing at such a time. No, do not give in to their false claims. In particular, a commitment was made last March, and based on the report I saw, this report is actually new. The other party did not fulfill those commitments, but we fulfilled ours. The other party in these commitments is the IAEA. I heard it did not fulfill its commitments. Anyway, be careful.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another important recommendation is that the existing nuclear industry's infrastructure must not be changed. During these years, the managers, officials, and those who are active in this industry have done important work and built important infrastructures. You may want to reach agreements in some areas. That's not a problem. You can have agreements, but the infrastructures must not be changed. They must not be harmed. These are the fruits of other people's endeavors. Well, you shouted, God is the greatest, too. May God make all of you successful. Of course, we were prepared to visit the exhibition for 25 minutes. I was given such a timeline, but it took twice that time. That is, we looked at the exhibition for an hour and a half, and now we were at your service. May you be successful and assisted by God, God willing. May God grant you prosperity. O Lord, for the sake of Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, bestow your grace, favor, and protection on our dear young people, our good managers, and our valuable active people in this industry. Make all of them honorable and proud in this world and the hereafter. O Lord, make our intentions in what we say and in what we do divine intentions, and accept them from us. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you all.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.